Welcome to Holden Village. This afternoon in the fireside room, Jack Sage will be teaching a session on women in Washington state history. So let's listen in on Jack.
I have over here a book that I picked up. I go to secondhand bookstores. I didn't know they had new bookstores. Anyway, this is called A Special Double Issue of Women in the Northwest, and it's a Pacific Northwest Forum. Summer of 1982, and it's everything about women. It has a lot of pictures of professional photographers took way back, starting at the turn of the century. And so if you get a chance, you want to look at it. Also have my Chinook jargon, some of the things there if you want to have a special blessing sometime, when some of them are pretty long, that they had Chinook jargon language. And then also at the very far corner is a little history of my family. Came in 1843 wagon train, and most of it is about the women in my family, who had a, they were something special. And I knew my great-grandmother. I didn't know my great-great-grandmother, but I did find her grave just a few years ago in eastern Washington. The book that I've shown you has a few pictures, and it says, why did these young women leave their family to work in isolated logging camps, and they are up in the logging camps. Some were assembled bombs in their basement, in the basement of the Bellingham Bon Marché during World War II. Now that's something I didn't know.
What did they do?
They assembled bombs in the basement of the Bellingham Bon Marché, and that has a picture of them doing
They weren't terrorists.
No. They were friendlies. In case you were wondering. Then it also showed some of the women in 1938 hand packing fish, and it was all women doing it. Women's club the first part of the century, and it showed them wartime riveters in 1940s. When we had a song called Rosie the Riveter, if some of you older people may remember that. Yeah. And it also showed a basketball game with LeConnor in the early 1900s. They had skirts and bloomers go down to their ankles, but they were playing basketball. It was all the women. They had an organized political action in Seattle in 1940, and it's also in there, a picture of it. Indian women tribal ceremony. Women's active role in the labor movement in 1915, and that's a picture in there of that. Creamery workers in Whatcom County, and women cannery workers. And then they had some personal photographs. These others, the first ones were professional photos. Then they had some personal photographs. It says a self-sufficient young woman with a rifle. I have an unfond memory about rifles. When I was courting my wife in eastern Washington, out in small towns, you always go squirrel hunting out in the scab rock. So we went out with, and she took along her brother for a chaperone. Anyway, we got out there, and there's scab rock. You've seen these pillars and stuff. Well, we had a rock quarry out there, and we were going out there to have a picnic. And so I put the rifle down on a little cliff, a shelf, and pretty soon my wife went over. She says, is this thing loaded? And she hit the trigger and went off and hit the rock wall and came back and put a chunk of the bullet in her cheek and a chunk in my ear. I've never had a loaded gun around her since. Everybody asked me why I married her, but I did. I was scared. And I was so innocent, Mary. It showed in 1909 a daily chores in a kitchen family. You'll ought to see the kitchen. They had cannery workers. Now, way back in the 30s, all the cannery workers were women. I can remember they had them at Puyallup Valley and also in the Yakima Valley. You'd work all day for a lot of times it was just piecework type thing, and it was hard work. And then it says, here's low-paid piecework at home in Quincy in 1914, which is across the river from the Chelan ways, close to Moses Lake. And that showed them a cannery sliming detail. And you know what they're doing? They're cleaning fish out on the dock in 1918. Anyway, that's kind of an interesting book if you want to take a look at it. Then there's some stories in there. One of them is Everyday Encounters with Indians and the White Woman in the Palouse. One woman wrote that. Another one was grew up in Pine Creek, Washington, in the Okanagan, not too far from here. Then the one I like best of all was about the real George Bush, George and Isabella Bush, Washington's first family. He came in 1845 to the state of Washington. He was in Oregon first. They would not let him own land, so he came up to Washington because he was black. And he was probably one of the first, he was one of the two pioneers that started Tumwater, or they call it New Market in the old days.
New Market?
New Market. That was what they called it. Because it was the first really little marketplace. Mm-hmm. The Indians would bring their stuff, their salmon, in there. And then a lot of the people raised stuff. It was, the soil was pretty good around Tumwater.
Would he have been a freed slave? Yeah.
Yes, both of them. And they bought their freedom. George Washington was the other one.
Yeah, I remember.
Yeah. So when... When I say to Washington, when they mention George Washington and George Bush, I always think of those two. I really do, because they had a lot to do with our starting the state of Washington. I think, were all of you here when I had yesterday? I'm going to repeat this again. Mary Walker was an early missionary wife. She was up in the Spokane mission, and she was by herself most of the time. Elkanah Walker, like all the men in those days, went from circuit to circuit, and the women were left to take care of the mission. And the women had to take care of the mission on $300 a year, raise family, garden, take care of the stock, and so forth. So Mary Walker wrote journals. She wrote such interesting journals. And one of the extracts I'm taking from it is so good. And I use it. Once in a while, they let me talk in church. And when I do, I've worked that one into the sermon. She says, I rose about 5, had early breakfast, got my housework done about 9, baked 6 loaves of bread, made a kettle of mush, and have now a suet pudding and beef boiling. My girl has ironed, and I have managed to put my clothes away and set my house in order. May the merciful be with me through the unexpected scene. 9 o'clock was delivered of another son.
Oh, my goodness.
All by herself. She had done. She was there almost 10 years, and she had 6 children. She also, she said, praying in public in presence of men was unseemly for women. Formal education of the Indians was frowned on also. Elkanah, her husband, objected to Mary reading in her short periods of spare time. That little rat, huh? Her 6th child was born shortly after the Whitman massacre in 1847. She's one of my outstanding women in history. There's a 4-volume set about 4 women in the West, and Mary Walker is one of them. And she's 1 volume is entirely in hers. And I wish I had that. I could tell you what the book was. It's an older edition, but it's one that I think everybody should read, men and women both.
I have a question, Jack.
Yes.
Somebody asked if was she one of the freed slaves, or was that one of the other?
No, not this.
Not Mary Walker. It was Washington Bush.
Isabella's.
Isabella. Were they?
I don't. I think she was white.
Oh, well, that's what I wondered.
Yeah. I think Isabella was white, and George Washington's wife was at least partially.
That's why they could own land.
Right. No. The only reason they could own land is the Washington State legislature, territorial legislature, passed a special bill so that they could do it for each one of them. One was in 1845, and the other one was 1850 for George Washington. Otherwise, and in Oregon, they could not own any property. Oregon, and one of the reasons was that most of the early settlers that came into Oregon were from the South. And they still carry. They were preparing for the Civil War in the 1840s. They didn't recognize the blacks of having any, even though they were freed persons. Mm-hmm. They didn't recognize them as having any rights to own property.
I was in an interesting situation because my ancestors, these came from there, and they were, I think they had slaves when they were in Virginia, but when they came out from Texas, they didn't have any slaves with them, although one of my cousins swears up and down, and I said, no, they didn't have any slaves that I know of. Because they weren't, if you had slaves, they would be listed in the census. And I've gone through the 1850, 1860, 1870, and 1880, and no slaves listed. A lot of children, and like today, children living with, our grandchildren living with them, you know, it wasn't any different then than it is now, so, families. Mm-hmm. I just picked up a book in our library in here. It's called Women's Diaries of the Western Journey by Lillian Schischel. And it had a little bit I want to let you know about women's diaries, how much different they are from men's. The diaries of men and women's carry certain predictable characteristics, with men writing of fights, conflicts, competition, and hunting, and women writing of their concerns with family and relational values. In the diaries of women, you see the Indians were described as helpful guides and purveyors of service, and less as enemies. Husbands are not often successful hunters. Sometimes they come back chasing buffalo around and have nothing, and the women kind of chuckle to themselves at what mighty hunters these men of ours were. They're not much different. And the rituals of care of sick and injured, this is one of the things they put in there. Men didn't mention much about that, but all of them, most of the journals and diaries I've seen, they put down all the deaths and everything. The rituals and care of sick and injured were done by the women. The men could care less. They saw the real enemies of the road was disease and accidents. Cholera was widespread during travel. And writing how bleak it was of the sick, often being left by the side of the trail to either recover or die. And that happened several times. And in the 1860s, when that happened, quite often the Indians would come up and kill them and for their household goods because they were helpless. They write of the deaths and burials. They tell of typhoid, mountain fever, measles, dysentery, and drownings. And they had a lot of drownings. Every time they crossed the river, their children especially, and some of the men were trying to get the cattle and stuff crossing, often they were drowned. They noted the particulars of each gravesite, whether it was new or old, whether it was a young or old person, whether it was disturbed by Indians or wolves. They were the actuaries of the road. And finally, it is suspected that many women judged the heroic adventure of their men as some kind of outrageous folly thrust upon them by obedience to patriarchal ritual. And I believe that. And one of the reasons, this historian here, when my people came out, they crossed the Kaw River, and it was late in May, about a week out of Missouri, and when their wagon's being ferried across the Kaw River, or it's Kansas River now, it tipped over and dumped all their children in. They had 9 children, and they lost most of their household goods. And so Sarah, my great-grandmother, tried to persuade Alexander, let's go home, she says. We've lost everything, we almost lost our children. And the rest of the travelers said, no, we'll give you household supplies if you go on. And so they did. And so they kept on. But I have a hunch that she was never too happy about that, because she had a lot of choice things saved in her wagon. One of the other things also, there's a book called Sons of the Prophets. I think you've seen that, Bill, haven't you? It's a story of Seattle. Anyway, there's something about, there wasn't too much about women in there, but there was some of it. One of them was, that chapter 10 was called The Hostess with the Mostess.
Yeah.
And then they call me madam, the ladies from Hades. it was a real choice. But November 28th, 23rd, 1883, the right of suffrage was held. So the women had the right to vote in 1883. However, in about 1888, the men were so scared that the women were going to get the right to vote, and when the Constitution came up for a vote, they would have no liquor allowed in there, and the right to vote, and a few other things. And so they finally got the court to say that that law was illegal. And so the women lost the right to vote until 1910. Anyway, the women in 1884, it didn't make any difference to them. It still had the right to vote. They had an apple orchard convention, which I think they met in somebody's backyard. And they elected all but the mayor in Seattle in 1884. All the councilmen, every office except the mayor was women. That really, after that, then that's when it bought time to change the law. If you can't win, you change the law, you know. There's a few little short items. I'll hit them. Women were in short supply, so Asa Mercer advertised to bring women out west for all these bachelors in the 1860s. A lot of them came out, but not as many as he wanted. He wanted 100, and he got a lot fewer, and I don't think the women were overjoyed with who they met. Having seen some of the scruffy ones when I worked after World War II, for instance. In 1900, Seattle's population was only 36% female. Today it's 50.2%, and this was in 1989. The first graduate of the University of Washington, the first graduate now, man or woman, and therefore the first graduate of State College in Washington, was Clara McCarty. She received a Bachelor of Science degree in 1876, the only member of her class of it to complete the degree requirements. And she died in Tacoma in 1929. All you Huskies that brag about your men, the first graduate was a woman. Okay. The legislature granted divorces to influential people without giving the wife a voice in the matter until the new constitution forbade such divorces in 1889. We had one governor who came in, and the only reason he wanted to be a governor was so he'd get a divorce from his wife. He was here one day, got a divorce, and left. And yes?
Where did Clara McCarty get her degree? From U of W?
U of W, mm-hmm. And it was the old U of W. It was on top of the hill. Yeah. I don't know if they sleuthed that hill down too or not, but they did some. But anyway, it was on the top of the hill. Oh, it's where first United Methodist Church is.
Downtown.
Yeah, it is. Oh, yeah, it's downtown.
Downtown.
Yeah, and that's the most expensive property for a church in Seattle.
Sure.
Yeah, I forgot. Yeah, that's where it is. That's that property. They own a few blocks around it, and they won't sell it. It belongs to the church. Yeah. Why should they give it up?
Washington is still a lot of them.
Yeah. They own property everywhere. Downtown. Yeah, and Washington State University has a lot of property by the land grant, because it's a land grant college. A lot of the farmland and so forth around the university over in Pomonas is a land grant that was given to them. The missionaries that came out, women missionaries, a lot of them, like Mary Richardson, the one that wrote, she wanted to be a missionary, but they wouldn't let her come out, so he had to get married. So she married Alcana Walker. It was a very short romance, and they moved west in 1838. And it's questionable whether they made any conversions, but they did make an impression on the west. Narcissa Whitman and Eliza Spaulding in 1837 became the first non-Indian women to travel overland to the territory, which included the state of Washington. That was 1837. Bill, this is for us. The Father's Day the nation observes each June was the idea of a Washington State woman, Sonora Smart Dodd, of Spokane, who started her campaign in 1910. Now we've got to bless her heart, because I've got some stuff I packed here I got on Father's Day. Puget Sound Express I got a hold of the 1870 to 1876 original copies of the paper. It was called Puget Sound Express, and it was printed in Steilacoom. And it had some comments about women, and most of them are pretty satisfactory. This is one that I kind of liked. It's simply absurd to talk about a woman being qualified to fill every position in life that man fills. For instance, what woman could lounge all day around the stove in a country grocery and lie about the number of fishes she caught last summer? I thought that was good. This is written by an editor. Sometimes he was against women, and sometimes he was for them, and he was a character. I got a kick out of him. He always had, this is like a little editorial he had. This is March 4th, 1875, that he wrote that. And then this is 1875, talking about women's rights. It says, "It's very common for the women's rights humbugs to close their nonsensical harangues with a beautiful tribute to women. Last at the cross, and first at the tomb." They might add that she was also last in the garden and first at the apple tree. A little bit of sarcasm from her. And then this is for the old days. That town, Stilcombe is the oldest incorporated town, and it had mostly saloons and hotels and a raunchy old man, I imagine. But anyway, this is 1875. It says, "For the damsels," it was a headline, "Let all the world know that the hundreds of bachelors are pining away in Puget Sound, waiting for the advent of simple, common sense, young and middle-aged women, willing to spend the remainder of their happiness and comfort on a ranch or in a little cottage by the sea. Especially on Stilicum Bay are many settlers who would submit to the burdens of the matrimonial yoke for the sake of having a good-natured partner to superintend their domestic affairs when seed time and harvest call them to the fields." This is June 3rd, 1875. "Ladies of Washington Territory, pray for the bachelors, or take up a collection for the old gals in the East, or do something to satisfy the old men." Now I'll get down to something serious. One of our real important women in the state of Washington was Mother Joseph. Yeah. And it took until 1981, I think, to recognize her. Anyway, she was born in 1823, and she was and died in 1902. She was a member of the Sisters of Providence, the Catholic Church. She reached Oregon December in 1856 after a harrowing 5 weeks journey, a 6,000-mile journey by ship from New York over the Isthmus of Panama and to California and up the Columbia River. She and her five French-Canadian colleagues looked for death as a release from the unrelenting seasickness and wild weather. December is the worst time of the year to come by ship, and I've read several stories of these people that came up the coast in December. All of them wanted to die, but they didn't have a chance. And then when they came up the Columbia River, that really scared them, because that is a scary, that mouth of that river is scary, and the weather was rough. Her maiden name had been Esther Parisot, and been born in Saint-Eliezer, Quebec. She was given the title Mother in 1864 when her domain in Oregon achieved provincial status. She built schools, shelters, and hospitals across the state. She used her on-the-job carpentry skills in these many projects in the name of Providence. She used to go down to when she was in Stilicum, she built a convent right next to the oldest Catholic church in the state. She used to go to the saloons, and she's called it panhandling, to get funds to build it. By the time she built that one, she'd had experience. She was an experienced carpenter, and she built, not only, if she couldn't get anybody else to help her, she did it herself. The U.S. Senate Concurrent Resolution No. 48, the 1st of April, 1980, accepted the gift of Mother Joseph's statue for the National Statuary Hall in Washington, D.C. Our other Washington State statue of Marcus Whitman, who died less than 10 years before Mother Joseph arrived in Oregon, is also in the hall in Washington, D.C. Some of Washington's greatest legacies were women, and there's a book called Washington Women as Pathbreakers.
Before you go on about Mother Joseph in Vancouver, I know that there was a hospital that she established, mm-hmm. St. Joseph's Hospital, and also an academy there, Providence Academy. And the old Providence Academy school building is still standing. It was bought by the Foster Hidden family who were the local brickmakers in that part of the state of Washington, Southwest Washington.
Oh.
And many of the buildings up as far as Olympia were built with hidden brick. And they bought it in the probably in the 60s.
Now, was that a red brick?
Right.
Was that a red brick? Really red brick? Bright red?
Yeah. Right.
Yeah. Very dark red.
Yeah, the salt was a soft brick as well. Well,
the reason I'm asking is because I was raised in Eastern Washington, Sprague. And Mother Joseph built an academy there, and they called it St. Joseph Academy.
Uh-huh. Well, anyway, I just meant that academy building is still standing. The Hiddens had hoped to make it into kind of a Giardelli San Francisco Mall, but it never turned out. But the building is still there for anyone who wanted to see it. It's still there with the chapel upstairs and so on. Quite a nice building.
Yeah, part of the academy is still there, and they tried to put a restaurant in it. It's a brick building. And I have fond memories of it because I used to be a paper boy in high school. And I'd bring it up and I'd use the side door and there'd be a young nun who was just starting in the order, evidently. She'd meet me every morning and I'd give her the paper. And then one morning I got up there and there was Mother Superior. Well, she took the paper and ever after this, I never did see that little nun. She was the cutest thing, I thought, you know.
Do you have the other location, all the other locations where she started her...
Oh, gosh, they're everywhere.
Providence Hospital in Seattle.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah. See, the Sisters of Providence was her order, and that there was a French... in fact, she had French girls with her, French young women. That
you went over the wall of Idaho, too.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, and that's a tough place to have up with those miners. She was scared of nothing.
Lived there for five years, so...
So she was a real a pioneer and a credit. I think she started over 100 institutions around the state and northern Idaho. But, yes?
Did you say she was recognized until 1980? I thought
Well, see, each state's allowed two statues of...
Yes,
of,
I know.
And,
Whitman was one.
Yeah, he was the first one.
And I was trying to remember what the other one was.
Mother Joseph.
Mother Joseph.
Mother Joseph.
Yes. Mother Joseph.
Uh-huh.
Yes.
1980.
Mm-hmm.
It took a long time.
All right, it took a long time because he was in there a long time.
Oh, he was. That. He was a man.
Yeah.
What the heck? You don't expect we're going to, you know.
Well.
Anyway, this book, Washington Women, is a Path Breakers, and it was 1989. 1989, we had a lot of books published at because that was our state centennial. Mm-hmm. And it was written by, and it was sponsored by the Junior League of Tacoma. The author was Mildred Tanner Andrews. It had a lot of the comprehensive history of Washington women and women's organizations from 1880 to 1940. And so if you get a chance to pick it up.
What was her last name?
Her last name? Andrews. Mildred Tanner Andrews. And it was published in 1989. And I think most any library still has it because it's fairly new. We have another woman who was originally came to Idaho, but she was a millionaire. And those of you who you know Spokane, know where the Hutton settlement is? Mm-hmm. It used to be an orphanage. Okay. Here she is. May Arkwright Hutton was born in 1860 and died in 1915. She came out on an immigrant train, a boxcar, I think it was, really, with about 48 men, and got off the train at Rastrum, Idaho, and then she went up into the mines, Kellogg and Wallace and Wardner and in that area, and she staked out a claim for a gold rush because they had a gold rush and silver mostly and other ores. And so she'd buy up the ones the guys would dig and get discouraged, so she'd pay a little bit and buy them. And she became very wealthy. I'll just kind of briefly go through here. This rags to riches story of one woman's rise from mining at Camp Cook. That's the first thing she did. She was a big woman. She weighed close to 300 pounds and is over 6 foot tall. And she was a gifted natural leader whose accomplishments matched her. She emerged out of the coal mines of Youngstown, Ohio, That's where she started in. She was a tough young, or tough woman. This illegitimate daughter of a wandering evangelist, and didn't say what denomination, but I knew it wasn't Methodist or Baptist, and herb doctor, she led 40 miners west to the placers of the Idaho Panhandle and succeeded in their fierce determination to get rich. With her tenacity and blunt language, and frightened petty officials out of their wits. You imagine that she was. I didn't bring the book. You can buy. I bought it. It was surplus, and Western Martian. See, that it's all about Eastern Martian. You want to get books reasonable? You go to the other side of the state, and yeah. You get them. I think I paid $2 for it. It's a good one. I got one for my one daughter who's a feminist, and. Because she really loved it. I bought two of them. I bought everything they had left, and it was brand new. Nobody ever used it. It also wanted to say that when she scared everybody else, her overflowing love embraced every unwed mother, prostitute, crippled logger, idle miner. She took on unwanted children as her own brood. She was independent, unsinkable, unflappable. She was her own woman. And she had no children of her own that I know of, but she was a very caring person. She was from 1907 to 1910, very active within the suffrage issue in Spokane, Washington, and where she had moved from Idaho after becoming independently wealthy with her mining holdings. She was a sharp woman. She would she bought all these claims, and then they got fortunes out of it later. She married a mining engineer who worshipped the ground she walked onto, which is surprising. Yeah, well, wealthy ground, you know, you betcha. You walk in gold dust, so you don't get particular. May believed that the ballot in the hands of women will do more to raise the standard of citizenship than all other reforms together. She locked horns with her women opponents of the vote, as well as the members of the Washington State Legislature. In 1910, the women were given the right of the vote, 10 years before it was granted nationwide. And she was one of the original pushers of it. And that's surprising.
Actually, a lot earlier than that, if you go back to 1883.
Well, yeah. Well, actually, it was way back. The men were so nice. They didn't want to fool the schools, so they let women run the schools. So they were allowed to vote school elections only. And they weren't allowed to vote in for the men's positions. And the men were so unworthy of the positions in the state of Washington territory that they could only serve one-year terms. And then you usually got the rascals out, you know, after that 1 year. There's a lot of the women we don't realize that were overlooked in history that were here a long time ago. And who was Princess Angeline? Seattle people should know who that is.
King Seattle's,
Chief Seattle's daughter, yeah. And she's she's a very popular early resident of Seattle, actually. Of course, it mentions Mother Joseph, the Sisters of Providence, who designed and built the city's Providence Hospital in 1881. She had a lot of influence in education, health care, and social welfare in the Northwest. Another woman was Sarah Jackson. Now, why I'm reading this is there was a workshop in 1987, I think it was in, 1987, at Highline Community College, between Seattle and Tacoma. And the women talked me into going. It was a workshop for women. And I was one of the best things I ever went to. We had speakers from all over the United States, and they had an all-day workshop. And I think they even paid my way to go, I think. In fact, they drove me, and they bought my meal and everything else. I don't know why they were so kind to me, except maybe they knew one day that I might be more favorable to them.
But this is the women from the church, Jack?
What's that?
Were these the women from the church that did this?
No, this is women in the community. No, the
and
women in the church.
And saw to it that you got there?
Yeah, this is genealogy women that did
see.
It. See, I belong to four genealogy societies all over the United States, and and this is the one, the local one. They said, "Hey, Jack, we want to get you out of town. We got a good workshop." And I said, "Sure, I'll go." And then they told me what it was, but I went anyway. It was good. And they had a woman by the name of Sarah Jackson, and that's a black woman in Seattle. She lives in the same house in Magnolia where she was born 72 years ago. So that would be, you see, that was a few years ago, not quite 10 years ago. She was an actress in the first theater for black actors west of the Mississippi. More than 30 years ago, she led a mother's march in Olympia in support of welfare appointments. And that was way back in the 1850s, or 1950s. Yet in the state's nearly 100 years of existence, the place of women in history has been obscured. Anyway, the workshop was good. I really enjoyed it. I've got a whole bunch of workbooks and so forth. What they wanted you to do, and which I've done also, is to get oral interview from women pioneers. And so I helped with that in Steilacoom. But the women have done a very good job. We have several women in my historical society that I also belong to. That we interviewed a lot of the pioneer women, and since then they've passed on. So we do have an oral record. If only thing is, we got to get it transcribed. It's on the tapes. I hope they transcribe better than I do. I've used tapes, it takes me a long time to do it. They mentioned some of the things here in this other article. I'll go on because it was a real interesting session. The Constitutional Convention in 1989 was another interesting thing in the state of Washington. It was still a territory. They fought over... 1889. I stand corrected. But it was during the summer of 1889, and there were 75 men put aside other business in the summer to become the single most important debating society Washington has ever known. They were delegates to the state convention. They spent 50 days, including Sundays, laying the foundation upon which all future laws of Washington would be built. All were white. Their average age was 45. They included two of the wealthiest men in the territory, 22 lawyers, 15 farmers, 4 stockmen, 6 doctors, 5 bankers, 5 merchants, and a smattering of laborers, miners, editors, and teachers. Republicans outnumbered Democrats 43-29, and the rest were independents. Delegate and Supreme Court Judge Stiles said of the convention, there were no cranks, but very few politicians in it. These men argued, twisted, and forged political compromises that produced a 30,000-word constitution. A constitution, I've got a copy of it. It's a good one. The best thing about it is they put amendments to it, like our Bill of Rights and the U.S. Constitution. They did make amendments, because the original one was a male-dominated one. Two things that they didn't do too well in. One was the convention refused to incorporate either women's suffrage or the prohibition of alcoholic beverages in the main body of the Constitution for fear of sinking the entire document in the upcoming special election. If they'd let the women vote, and because it didn't have those things in there, they were probably lose the Constitution and have to do it all over again. That's their excuse. Instead, the delegates put both issues on the ballot as a separate articles. And October 1st, the voters of the territory approved the Constitution but killed suffrage and prohibition. And that was the male voters. And they didn't have any female voters. The lobbyists for women's suffrage did win one crumb, however. The Constitution, as approved by both the convention and the voters, authorized the legislature to allow women to vote in school elections. So, when we had our state constitution, they were allowed to do that. As an instrument of political compromise, the Constitution was much to the delegates' liking. So they did get a little bit, but they didn't get in. And this is a little bit what they've done over the years. It did offer a ray of hope for women and minorities. It required the state to make ample provisions for the education of all children residing within its borders, without the distinction or preference on account of race, color, caste, or sex. And they even added that in the last. The earliest minority group to approach equality with English-speaking whites was the black population. Some of the earliest pioneers to settle north of the Columbia River were blacks who came here to escape enforcement of the Oregon territorial law against black settlement. And the 15th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution gave black men the right to vote and to hold office. But black women, like those of other races, remain disenfranchised. And so they're staying together. Women form one of the most persistent and effective political movements in Washington's history. For more than 40 years, and starting in the 1860s, they persuaded and fought for the right to vote and hold office, and they won many battles on the way to winning the war. In 1871, Susan B. Anthony, nationally prominent suffragist, came on a lecture tour of the Northwest, accompanied by a young Oregonian, Abigail Scott Duniway. Now, I don't know if any Oregonians here. We had some before. Anyway, she was a fighter, Duniway. Anthony stirred the pot, and Duniway stayed to turn up the heat, earning the title Mother of Woman Suffrage in Washington, according to historian T.A. Larson. She wrote forcefully in her publication, New Northwest, and she lobbied hard, rallied women to the cause. Finally, Duniway and her supporters persuaded the territorial legislature to grant women's suffrage in 1883. We've already mentioned that. They turned out a corrupt city administration in Seattle and obtained strict enforcement of ordinances regulating gambling, liquor sales, and prostitution. The men probably were upset with Mercer for even demanding more women to come out here because they were really turning things over in that city of sin, which I always called Seattle because I was a Tacoma boy. But the women's worst offense in the eyes of many men was to vote local areas dry, much to the disgust of the liquor industry and drinking men. That's why they canceled the right for women to vote in 1887 and 1888. And this is bad for the state of Washington, for the women, because that's when they adopted the Constitution. Another one that came out here was a woman by the name of DeVoe. Emma Smith DeVoe, arrived in Tacoma from Illinois and began to revitalize the movement. She was articulate and charming, and the wife of a Northern Pacific Railway agent who encouraged her work for the rat. By 1909, in spite of strife within the women's movement, DeVoe and her forces got the suffrage back on the ballot. And so in 1910, they passed it. And that it wouldn't have been done unless these named women hadn't got in there and really gone at it. I have several books that you might be interested in about the women's in the Northwest. One of them is called Sowing Good Seeds. That's put out by the Oregon Historical Society Press. And it's mostly about Susan B. Anthony. And it was reviewed here by Murray Morgan, who is well-known in the Tacoma area and I think also Seattle. She addressed the Washington State Territorial Legislature in 1871. And it told a little bit what she said. Oh, she almost got it passed in 1871. It went to the House, and amendment lost 13-11. Pretty close.
Yeah.
Very close. But it's a good book if you be interested. It was published in 1991. So it's a new one. Two more books. One was called Character as Destiny and Converting the West. And this is a biography of Narcissa Whitman, the last one. And it's the University of Oklahoma Press. University of Oklahoma Press publishes a lot of Northwest books. I'm surprised, but I get a list from them. And bookstores, you'll often find it. They do a good job. And they take authors that are from this area, and they do publish it. It has a detailed story, a background of Narcissa, as well as the ending of it. There's another one about a woman by the name of Nina Jolidon Croak. She's a mystery feminist of Tacoma politics, and she was in the 1923 until 1934. She was the first one elected to legislature, a woman to be elected to legislature, state of Washington. And it's a little story about it. Murray Morgan reviewed it. She was here for long enough to get into the legislature. She said, she ran against how many guys? There was about four guys. But her campaign speech was, "I'll make few promises, but this I will say, I am willing and eager to learn and will always be found at my post doing the very best my conscience dictates." They had six candidates, two Republicans, two Democrats, and two progressives who were competing for two positions. The races were not for individual seats. The two candidates from the 37th district, isn't that yours, Bill?
38.
Oh, it's pretty close. It's 37th district. Receiving the most votes was to go to Olympia, the first of the highest two votes. It was a close run race. Doctor, she was a doctor, Jola Don Crook finished second, 9 votes behind one of the Republicans, but 68 ahead of the other Republican. So she was elected. Her election was challenged by a Democrat who finished fourth. He complained she had violated the rule against campaigning within the tolling station, but she explained that she had used her machine, her car, to drive. She was one of the first women in Tacoma to drive, incidentally, to bring 7 friends to the polls. And they were already committed to vote for her victory, and she had not needed to campaign. Her victory was certified. She was quite a woman. And that's I've never heard of her before until this August. Miss Murray Morgan found this book about her, and I've got to find more about that because that sounds interesting. There's another book that probably the women would be interested in. It's called First Families. It's Washington State's First Families, the governor's families. Our governors were a bunch of characters, some of them. And it was the redeeming factor was the women we had in the mansion. They were, I've met several of them over the years, and they've been real good people. So I'm glad that they had them. But anyway, it's a little bit stories about the different ones. One of them, her husband was elected. Cosgrove was the governor. He was elected the governor, and he served one day. He got sick, and so he says, "I'll come back." He says, "And as soon as I could feel better," he didn't. So she was only in the building for one day, in the mansion. These Cosgroves, though, were something else. She didn't give up after that. Well, she was still very active. Moved to Pomeroy, which is in the southeastern part of the state. She practiced law, served as a delegate to the Washington Constitutional Convention in 1889, or he was, and he was also president-elect for William McKinley, but he lost out when after he got elected governor. They talked about Hay. He was another governor, but they moved into this 19-room mansion. How many of you have been in that mansion? It's quite a place. I've gone there. One I liked best is when Dixie Lee Ray was there. I wasn't too happy with her, but she was a Democrat that time. And so when she invited some of us to go, she is quite an artist, or was. She used to take these wood shakes, cedar shakes, and carve Indian symbols and stuff on them and paint them. And she has this one room in the very back of the mansion on the bottom floor. She had all the walls just lined them in beautiful things. She did real work. I says, "Gosh, I didn't know you were that talented." "Well, I'm not just a nuclear scientist," she says. She was a pig farmer, too. That's what she had on her Fox Island farm, was pigs. And she was very casual. They go to interview her, reporters go over, and she'd be dressed in an old sweatshirt, pushing pigs around, trying to get them into their pens. And she wasn't very dignified. Her sister was a very dignified woman. And so whenever we had any special meetings with her, we met at the sister's house over in Fox Island instead of Dixie's.
Her sister was in my class at State.
Yes, right.
And I knew Marion, and we were in scouting, and Dixie, mm-hmm. So I knew them both.
Her house.
I knew the family. Yeah. There were 5 girls. Raised at North Golden in Tacoma.
Have you been to her home that was on Fox Island?
No, I
haven't. It was right close to the bridge. It was a nice big one. Mm-hmm. And real, real nice. And her sister was a real lady. She was
yes.
Very.
And Dixie was a good person, too.
Well, she was on a...
Ever,
She was something in a group, but by herself, she was a nice person to talk to. I enjoyed visiting with her.
I think she was the boy of the family, you know. More.
She's a tomboy.
Tomboy.
Yeah, she was a tomboy. Okay, there's another about another book he reviewed. That's Murray Morgan. It's about the Longmires. Now, this Longmire, it used to be a little village down there one time on the farm. Longmires came across an 1853 wagon train, and two families I know besides Longmires also was the Light family, E.A. Light, who settled in Steilacoom. My grandfather knew the Longmires because he had a ranch on the road that came across the old Natchez Pass, and so they were friends that raised cattle, and so they had common things, common interests. Longmires developed that, and they had hot springs. When I first went there, the hot springs were operating, but now they've died out. We have another woman who's the only one living in a little town in the mountains, a little town of Lester. I don't know if any of you have been fortunate enough to visit Lester like I have, because that was a little railroad town. That's the only way you could get to it for years. The city of Tacoma has bought out all the property in the Tacoma watershed, and it's in that little valley that where Lester is. They quit running the railroad through there, and they use the Great Northern tracks now, so they don't even use the Stampede Tunnel anymore. So they bought out everybody but Gertrude, and Gertrude says, I'm not going to move. And she got sick and had to be a leave, and she's 90 now. And she came back. She says, I'm coming back, and nobody's going to push me around. And it's the doggonedest place you ever saw. A lot of, kind of like the old-fashioned hillbillies. You'd think nobody lived in those hills, except at night when you're on a train, you look and you see cabin lights all through the woods, all the way from Kanaskat through to Lester, which is quite a ways. There were characters. During World War I and II, these people moved into those cabins, so they wouldn't be drafted, and they stayed there ever since. There's one family of their parents died, but they have three brothers, and they had cabins side by side, and they would not speak to each other. Once a week, they get on the train Saturday night and go to Auburn or to Roslyn or someplace to celebrate. They wouldn't talk to each other. They had three separate seats. They hadn't talked to anybody, and their voices are high-pitched because they hadn't used them in all that time that they're... And I don't know. I think they finally they died. I don't know. They were characters, little old hermits, you know. No woman would live with them, that's for sure. I have another. I'm getting close, aren't I? The history of the black women. One of the problems I have with I try to push these people in Tacoma and other places. Judge Tanner, I tried to get him to write a history of his family, because they've been in Tacoma for a long, long time. And he's retired federal district judge in Tacoma. And Frank Burgess took his place and he's also a black. Frank Burgess is a much better man than Jack was, because I knew them both. Jack used to be in my party, and I wasn't too happy about that. But Jack says, well, there's nothing to write about. But his family were one of the first black families in Tacoma. And I think his dad worked as a janitor or something for one of the schools. But Jack went to law school and became a lawyer, and then a judge. I don't remember which one of the senators appointed him from the state of Washington as a judge. He has, for a long time, he was a lawyer for Bob Setiakam, the Indian that was tried and went up to Canada and hid out up there and finally died. I knew Bob Setiakam too when he was a Democrat. He was a Republican and he was everything else. But they are the exception. But the women, we never hear anything about them. The usual records, you know, like diaries and letters and so forth, are very lacking on the subject of the black women. But their lives are probably more significant because most of the women work. Most of the black women have worked. Some of them have been on welfare, but most of them had jobs. They were housekeepers and so forth. They labored in cities, farms, and mining towns. They were mothers and grandmothers, and they established church groups and clubs that helped meet the needs of their communities. I'm a volunteer at Western State Mental Hospital, and so every spring we have an honor luncheon for all of them. We have some black women who have been coming there for 30 years volunteering to help patients in the hospital. They're church groups, they are a different fringe of Baptists than Bombil here, but they are Baptists, most of them, and they do a very good job with and the patients really love them. And so they're only recognized by the state, Western State Hospital. You don't see it in the newspapers or anything else. We can make, with some assurance, we can make certain generalities about black women in the Pacific Northwest. Their total number, like that of black men, was very small. Less than 1% before 1920, and that's not very a large percentage. Unlike white pioneer women who live largely in farms, the majority of black women live in the urban areas. And most were married, most were employed, often as servants. Although black women in the Pacific Northwest had many things in common with all Western women, both white and non-white, they were unique in their blackness. No other group of women were slaves, former slaves, or the daughters of previously enslaved people. And when they came out here, they were almost treated like slaves again. And that Oregon was one of the worst places for it. They mentioned in here about another one, a woman by the name of Mamiya Travers. And she was a 45-year-old slave, and she was freed by her master, Captain Llewellyn Jones, at Fort Vancouver in 1851. No explanation was given on the brief record, but the captain added a note 6 years later stating that she is an honest and perfectly conscientious woman that deserves kind and good treatments in the hands of everyone. So a lot of the freed ones were released, not in Vancouver, or not in Portland, but in Vancouver, because it was in Washington Territory.
And you know what? My remembrance of, and we moved to Olympia in 48, there for 3 years. It seems to me I was really surprised to learn that Olympia had maybe one or two black families. And kind of the rumor, it wasn't a pronounced thing in the paper or anything, but the word was that Olympia always shoot them on through, And it really blew my mind, though, that Olympia in that late state was... Yeah. Was so negative toward blacks.
Well, a good share of your population in Olympia quite often is, lobbyists and politicians and so forth. However, the black families there have been the longest as George Bush. They had a homestead close to Olympia Airport, and some of the family are still there. And of course, they've intermarried, but they still own some of the property. The house is a big two-story ranch type house. And I've seen pictures of it. I haven't been to it. But there have been articles ever so often about them. But there wasn't, otherwise there was very few there. And see, they came when it was a territory. Now, after the Constitution came in, they're a little bit different. Olympia's a little bit different. Here's one thing I just want to cover quickly. Coal mining in the activity in Washington in the 1880s helped create one of the few black towns in the far west, Roslyn. Now, we don't realize that it was mostly a black town. Now, those of us who've been out to the cemetery, you see 26 different cemeteries. Most of them are fairly small groups. You weren't going to be, if you were a Swede, you didn't want to be buried next to a Norwegian and not that kind of thing. So they've all got their little separate graveyards. They have Redmond's, Oddfellows, Masonic, even two Druid graves. But the biggest grave site in there is the blacks. There's over 200 blacks buried in there. And I went in there last summer, took pictures of the few monuments that are left. There are probably about half a dozen, and about two or three of them have been vandalized. The big ones have been, I don't know, they took hammers to them or something and broke them up. But I met some of the Craven family, and they mentioned that the Craven family stayed there after it. They were brought in as strike breakers. The whites didn't want to work for the pay that they were going to get, and so they imported, Northern Pacific Railroad imported several hundred blacks, and their families are still there. And it's one of the few areas in eastern Washington that has a heavy black concentration. And that's Roslyn, where Sicily, Alaska is really. I want to straighten you out on that, you know.